Thank you very much. I find it interesting that they put me in the treatment innovation section. Maybe there was some confusion that I was going to be talking about treatment for marijuana dependence, but that is not what I'm going to be talking about. So I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, and San Francisco and the surrounding areas are really unique to the world in that not only has California passed medical marijuana legislation, but they've actually established a dispensing system for medical marijuana patients. And am I talking too loud? No? Yes? I'm getting mixed feedback. I'll stand back a little bit. I have a loud voice. I probably don't even need the mic. So I felt like I was in a really unique situation to go into these dispensaries and to look at how they were operating as health service providers. And my interest came from watching the news, and it seemed that every time they talked about dispensaries, they would show the same file footage of a bag of pot about that big, and that was about all you saw. And I knew there had to be more going on over there. So I figured a doctoral dissertation was the perfect chance to go and do this research. And so back in 2005, that's what I did. When am I pushing to advance? Ah, there we go. So just a brief history for those people that are not that familiar with medical marijuana legislation and history. In California, the first medical marijuana legislation was actually a citywide bill that was passed in 1992 called Proposition P, which was passed in San Francisco and spearheaded by Dennis Perrone, whose partner was suffering from HIV/AIDS and had begun kind of this informal dispensing system out of his home in San Francisco, where ill people would come and he would provide them with medical cannabis and give them a venue in which to use their medicine. And he was worried that the police were going to come, that the DEA was going to come. He didn't know what to do, so he decided that he needed protection, and he spearheaded Proposition P. Then in 1996, the first state medical marijuana law was passed in California, Proposition 215, which allowed ill Californians to use marijuana under a doctor's care. And although since 1996, 11 other states and various cities within states in the U.S. have passed medical marijuana legislation, it is still illegal under federal government. And in fact, just as recent as last week, 4 dispensaries in the Bay Area were raided by the DEA. So it is still a big point of contention between the feds and the states. As far as the medical cannabis facility history, just a quick caveat. I started off using the language of dispensary because that's what I always heard on the news, and then I was informed by one of the managers of the facilities that they prefer facility, partially because the word dispensary alludes to the fact that they are actually dispensing an illegal drug. So to protect themselves, I will be using facility. So the first medical marijuana facility was Dennis Perrone's home. There are 2 models that are currently used in the Bay Area. One is the social club model, which incorporates other types of services besides just the dispensing of cannabis. And then there's the pharmacy model, which has been co-opted in the Netherlands, which is more of a drugstore model where you walk in, you get your medical cannabis, and you leave. The people don't hang out there, they don't offer extra services. The rules vary from city to city, including the limits on how many facilities can operate in a city. Oakland is allowed to have 4 facilities at any given time, and each facility has to apply with the city, and then they choose 4. There's lots of rules and regulations concerning how close they can be to churches, schools, drug treatment centers, youth programs, things like that. There are currently 3 operational facilities in the city of Berkeley. And San Francisco used to have over 40. I always thought that was kind of funny that San Francisco had more facilities than McDonald's. But recent changes by the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco are changing that because they are also implementing rules about distances that facilities can be from schools and churches and public areas. So many of the facilities that used to operate, now when they have to go through the relicensing procedure, they're no longer allowed to operate in their current facility, and they have to find someplace else. Another issue in California is unincorporated areas. They have even more of a problem than the cities because they really don't have any kinds of rules or regulations from a governing body in order to help those facilities set up. So my question, going back to that news stories with the big piles of marijuana, was what about the patients? Who are they? Why are they there? What are they like? What do they like about facilities? What don't they like about facilities? I felt that just because there was a legal situation didn't mean that we shouldn't treat these as any other health service, would that deserve to be evaluated, improved, develop best practice models, everything that you would do with another type of community health service provider. So I decided to do the cannabis care study, which was many, many parts. I'm not going to be talking about all of them today, but the three main parts were the description of medical cannabis patients and facilities, which is what I'm going to go into today, a patient-based evaluation of services, and a description of facility service utilization. So today I'm going to be talking about descriptions of medical cannabis patients, looking at demographics, insurance, length of symptoms and treatment, general health status, and most importantly, I think, for this section is the issues of self-medication and substitution of cannabis for alcohol and other prescription or illegal drugs. Oh, and also, because I worked with the alcohol research group, had a little alcohol bent in there, so I also asked patients about the presence of previous alcohol treatment, whether it was their choice to go to treatment, their satisfaction with various types of alcohol treatment, because I was thinking there might be some commonalities between alcohol treatment preferences and dispensary models. So for example, a patient that preferred 12-step may prefer a social type model, whereas a patient that preferred inpatient hospital-based alcohol treatment might be more comfortable with a pharmacy model. And it was also a patient-based evaluation of services, which I'm not going to go into too much today, but I used the patient satisfaction questionnaire, which is a standardized measure, to look at general access and interpersonal satisfaction. And then I also added a dimension for privacy, because this is something that was relayed to me as being very important to patients. And I also did a description of facility service utilization with site-specific patient surveys, looking at the social model, the variety of services that were offered. So I had a ton of research questions. I'm only going to focus on the first five today, like I talked about demographics, health, self-medication and substitution, treatment for alcohol-related issues, and the types of treatment that were chosen. And then at the end, if I have time, I do have a slide on the other services that are offered by facilities besides marijuana distribution, which always blows everyone away. So I hope that I can get to that today. I'll end with that. So my methods, this was completely exploratory. I mean, as exploratory as studies get. I had 130 patients, which is actually the largest sample of medical marijuana patients outside a hospital that's in existence. So this area has not really been studied at all. I had 7 study sites, 2 facilities in Berkeley and 5 in San Francisco. I administered both facility-level surveys to managers of facilities to find out what kind of services they offered, as well as patient-level surveys. I collected all the data myself, again, one of the great things about a doctoral dissertation. The surveys were completely anonymous, and all the sampling was done at the facilities. The facility survey for the managers I designed myself, as well as the patient survey, but I also included the RAND 36-item health survey and the patient satisfaction questionnaire. Basically, for sampling, I approached facilities. I told them what I wanted to do. For the most part, they were really willing. I have to really give a lot of kudos to the patients because they were really willing to share their stories with me, which is something I was a bit surprised about. I self-administered the surveys when needed, so if somebody couldn't read or couldn't see. Otherwise, they took the surveys themselves. I asked everyone who came into the facility while I was there if they'd like to take a survey, and I visited different facilities at different times to try to get as wide a sample as possible. So here are some results. So as you can see, most were men, 74% men, 25% women, and although there's been a lot of lip service to, you know, all these young people going into dispensaries and they just want, you know, marijuana, these 18, 19-year-olds, as you can see, only 15% of the sample was in the age range of 18 to 24, and in fact, most were in the age range of 36 to 45 at 26%, and 11% were in the age range of 56 to 65 years old. One other interesting thing is that you can see 18% of the sample was Native American. And I'll get back to that in a minute, but I think that that really speaks to the willingness to go to alternative therapies and herbal remedies for illness. 20% African American, about 60% Caucasian, 12% Hispanic. 75% of the sample had health insurance, but you can see that 38% of those were Medi-Cal, which is our public health insurance program. They're mostly low income, 60% with incomes below $20,000 a year, but also 6% above $100,000 a year. So I think that this shows the wide variety of patient types that utilize facilities in San Francisco. I also asked patients how long ago they'd first been treated for the illness that brought them to the dispensary that day, and how long they've been having symptoms. And as you can see, we've got people that were just first treated very recently to people who were first treated 57 years ago, and people who have never had symptoms to people who have had symptoms since birth, or about 60 years. I did not ask patients why they had come into the facility that day. I didn't want to make them feel like I was judging whether or not they should be there or not. They get that a lot. I was more interested in just how they were as patients. Health status, you can see if one is perfect physical health, they're averaged 0.54 for physical health, 0.46 for emotional health, and 0.67 for general health, and this was using the RAND 36 item survey. 20% of the sample had been in alcohol treatment previously, and of those, 73% had been in treatment 1 to 3 times, and almost all of them, it was their decision to enter treatment. The most popular type of treatment was outpatient, inpatient, and 12-step programs, with 12-step programs being the most popular mode of treatment. Again, this will add up to more than 100 because people had gone to several different types of treatment. And if you look at satisfaction, I know this is a really busy slide, but 12-step was really dichotomized, with 35% feeling like it wasn't helpful at all, and about the same percent feeling that it was very or extremely helpful. Now this is kind of what I wanted to focus on a little bit more today, was the issues of self-medication and substitution among medical marijuana patients. So how I defined self-medication on the survey was the personal decision to use a substance not prescribed by a doctor to treat symptoms. And so you can see that 47% of the sample reported self-medicating with alcohol, and 76% reported self-medicating with legal non-prescription drugs. And this is like herbal supplements. I think that this goes back to the point earlier about 18% of the sample being Native American. And 55% had self-medicated with illegal non-prescription drugs. I then asked them the substitution question, which is, for what substance do you use cannabis as a substitute? And you can see that half the sample reported using cannabis as a substitute for alcohol, almost half reported using cannabis as a substitute for illegal drugs, and 74% reported using cannabis as a substitute for prescription drugs. I then asked the patients, why did you choose cannabis as a substitute? The most popular response was that there were less negative side effects from cannabis use, followed by better symptom management and less withdrawal from cannabis use than from their previous medication. I asked about satisfaction using the patient satisfaction questionnaire, the satisfaction with services, and they were fairly high. I don't have the other numbers with me, but I do know that they were higher than the nationally reported satisfaction rate for healthcare, with the highest being interpersonal satisfaction at 0.87. and privacy at 0.86. I also asked if they had used cannabis that day. We were thinking there may be this high and happy effect where patients were very happy with the dispensaries because they had used their medication. And you do see that 81% of the sample had used cannabis that day because I was sampling at the facility. So the norm was that patients would come in, they would get their medicine, they would sit down, and then they would do a survey. I also asked patients to rate on a scale of 1 to 10 why they chose that particular facility. And I think that this goes along with other types of community-based health services, that the most popular answers were that they were familiar with the facility, that they were comfortable and secure with going there, and that they really liked the staff. So I think that that speaks to kind of this community-based health service model that's going on. Okay, so this is really cool. Family, I have 2 minutes left. So I was also interested in what kind of services were offered by these facilities besides the distribution of cannabis. A lot of the research on chronic illness shows that it's very important for patients to have access not only to medical care and doctors, but to other types of services that help them bond with other patients in similar situations, feel empowered over their position with their illness, and also take their mind off the fact that they have an illness. I think you see this model used in a lot of cancer centers today that offer care, support groups, but also recreation to patients. And that was something that was definitely seen in the social model of facilities. Substance abuse treatment services were offered, such as NA and AA meetings and harm reduction meetings. There are also social support groups for women, veterans, men, and creativity, such as writers groups, quilters groups, and entertainment, like puzzles, open mic. I went to bingo. It was a blast. Internet access, which you can see a large percentage of the sample is low income, so having access to internet and to library is very important. They also offer cannabis-related services like grow classes, legal classes, activism, and community events like clothing drives and neighborhood parties. And social services such as counseling, housing, help, food, hospice referrals. So these are three places if you'd like to know more about medical cannabis in California and other states. The first, actually, they had a booth here at APHA's Americans for Safe Access, which is an advocacy group based out of Washington, D.C. California Normal, which is the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and Dr. Frank Lucido, who is a prominent physician in Berkeley who administers many medical marijuana recommendations and also has a very informative website. So thank you very much for allowing me to speak.